This is an examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast
with Tony Bruschi.
We are talking with Thomas Brennan. He's the private investigator that has been hired and has been working the Ellen Greenberg case since the authorities in Pennsylvania seem to think, stabbing yourself 20 times, suicide, right? It's what happens when you have to take justice into your own hands. As Sandra and Josh Greenberg have done, the parents of Ellen Greenberg. Thomas, let's start here in our conversation and bring us into understanding how you got acquainted with the Greenbergs.
Two friends of mine, one a retired dentist and the other a judge in the Dauphin County Court of Common Pleas, William Tully. They both were friends of the family, and the parents were struggling. Mm-hmm. And they knew what I did, that I did. I still worked homicides, so in cold cases. So they arranged for a meeting with the parents, and we sat down, and the parents told me what in fact they were doing. This was March of 2013, mm-hmm. And they provided me with the documentation and some photographs that they had. Scene photographs that were taken by the medical examiner's investigator. I told him, I said, well, give me a chance to take a look at these and then I'll get back to you. And we did, I got back to them and I told him, I said, well, in my opinion, it in fact is a homicide. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, the father, Josh, he's a character. He said, well, what's this going to cost me? And I said, well, I don't make money on somebody else's grief. I said, if you cover my expenses going to Philadelphia, I said, and back, I said, that'll be it.
Sure.
You don't have to worry about my time. And that's the way it's been. And that's how I got involved in it.
This is obviously a very troubling case for obviously many reasons. One of the first most obvious being the likely physical improbability or impossibility that Ellen could have stabbed herself 20 times and made it through 20 times and still survived long enough to do that. When you initially heard about this case and you saw some of that evidence and you heard the story, if we're just focusing on the manner of death, what was going through your mind when you learned about it, first being looked at as a homicide, then a suicide, homicide, back to suicide? What was your reaction to that?
I started looking at it and, looking at the crime scene, and there's, first of all, I understand what, the parents told me that, the fiance broke into the apartment, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It was a real stormy, I think it was the biggest nor'easter that ever hit Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. A lot of snow. And they had an early dismissal at Ellen's school.
Okay.
The victim. And the one thing, I'll never forget what they told me right at the beginning. There were a series of phone calls, about probably 10 or 15 calls, all outgoing, mm-hmm. and started with a code. And they said, look at this. See how she was evidently she was really having a problem here. Look at all these phone calls. Mm-hmm. I said, did anybody ever call them to see who they were? They said, no. So I started calling them.
Sure.
They were the parents of the children in our classroom. Okay.
Yeah.
And the code was that they didn't show where they were coming from. They didn't show Ellen's cell phone number. That's all it was.
Sure. Sure.
So, that's how things started. And then you take a look at the crime scene itself, the photograph. There are no police photographs, I can tell you that right now, of the crime scene. The Philadelphia Police Forensics Unit was never at the crime scene.
Why?
Okay.
I mean, wouldn't this just be a common sense thing to do with someone who's been stabbed 20 times?
Well, what everybody has to understand here, Tony, is that the police did not know about the stab wounds to the back of the neck or the scalp.
Okay.
Until autopsy. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, the 27th.
Okay.
Nobody knew about those. So the police at the scene, okay, who said this was a suicide, and I have documentation to that effect.
Yeah.
They said it was a suicide that night.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They didn't move the body. They didn't do anything. They never called the forensics unit out. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That night, the night of the 26th, when at 6:40, when she was pronounced by an EMS, fireman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Philadelphia Police Department fireman. Nobody at that time, nobody knew about those wounds. Nobody knew about the wounds at the back of the neck. So the only thing they did was suicide. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right from day one. And well, the next morning, while Ellen's being autopsied, the victim is being autopsied, the husband, James Schwartz, the prominent attorney uncle, James Schwartzman, mm-hmm. calls and wants to get into the apartment. Okay. So the property manager told him, she said, let me call the police. So she calls the police and the police said, yeah, you can let him in.
And this, so we understand who this is, James Schwartzman. He's a prominent attorney. He's part of which family here, Samuel Goldberg or Ellen Greenberg's family?
Goldberg.
Okay, so part of
Samuel Goldberg.
Part of her fiance's family. Okay.
Yeah. All right. So the police tell the property manager, yeah, you can let him in. The property manager says, well, it's all bloody.
Mm-hmm.
The scene's all bloody. They said, well, you can call crime scene cleanups. They'll come over and clean it up. So she calls crime scene cleanups. They come over and clean and sanitize the scene.
Okay.
He comes in. The prominent attorney uncle and another individual comes in. They come in. And not only do they get a suit and shoes for the fiance,
mm-hmm.
for the funeral, okay, they also remove all of the laptops. They remove the victim's laptop, her work laptop, her personal laptop, and her cell phone. And all of her credit cards, her wallet, everything. He takes it all, including the fiance's laptop also. Okay. So anyone who says that, well, anything that comes out those laptops at all in the future can be challenged.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because the police should have seized those right at the scene, but they didn't. They left them.
Is that because they were still thinking of this as being a suicide, so there wasn't a lot of oversight?
They need to take them all.
Okay. Yeah.
And I have an incident memo by a uniformed police officer that was at the scene, okay? And he says in his incident report, okay, it's titled Suicide,
mm-hmm.
okay? Suicide. And it says, homicide was there, and so was the medical examiner's office. Okay? Mm-hmm. Guess who shows up to 28?
Who?
At the apartment. The police.
Okay.
To perform a search.
All these days later.
Now, the medical examiner said on the 27th, this is a homicide.
Okay.
So now, because the scene was never, ever secured, now they have to go out and get a search warrant, okay, to go back in and search the apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are they going to get from the apartment? Nothing, because it's been cleaned and sanitized.
Yeah.
About the only thing that you could do, maybe you might get some results with a luminol test.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even do that.
Look at this and you go, is this sloppy police work? Is this because maybe things were limited? You had the nor'easter going on, and sometimes it makes hard to get from point A to point B. Or is there something else at play here?
I don't know, because according to that report that I told you about,
mm-hmm.
according to that report, the fiance was taken into police district headquarters in Philadelphia to be interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
We have never been allowed to see any police reports. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what was said. I don't know who was there. You know, so I can't tell you any of that.
Okay.
And, you know, I've heard a lot of rumors that he was represented by counsel. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just don't know. I just don't know. When you take a look at that, the scene itself,
mm-hmm.
okay, as soon as you go into the apartment and you see the victim lying, you know, propped up in this corner in the kitchen on the floor, immediately look, you take a look at that and it's, whoa, wait just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just a minute. You know, and then you see dried and coagulated blood, you know, that should be running, you know, the way the victim is positioned, it should be running vertically.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, it's running horizontally to the ear. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you take a look at that, and then you do things like you take a listen to the 911 call.
Yeah.
And you hear the fiance telling everyone that she's on her back. Well, in the photograph, she's not on her back. She's sitting up.
That's an inconsistency.
Okay. Because Philadelphia Police Department, District Attorney's Office, Medical Examiner's Office, they are, you know, all three entities completely refuse to do anything, you know, cooperate with us at all.
Yeah.
At all. And, you know, and then... Tony, I don't know. I don't know. Even like with, okay, you talk about Dr. Galino. Dr. Galino was the medical examiner for the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office, okay? Mm-hmm. He since resigned. But anyway, when I first got involved in this, the first thing I did was contact him.
Sure.
Okay. Now, you have parents who believe their daughter was killed and didn't commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
I called him and I say, Dr. Galino, I'd like to interview Dr. Osborne.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He's the doctor that did the autopsy.
Okay.
Dr. Galino says no.
Why is that?
Okay. So about a year goes by and, you know, I'm doing some other things on the case, and I contact Dr. Wayne Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because I know Dr. Wayne Ross is a court certified expert in stab wounds.
Okay.
So I want him to take a look at this case. So I give everything that I have to him. He takes a look at it, comes back to me and says, hey, Tom, you're right. This is a homicide. There's no way in hell this is a suicide. Mm-hmm. I said, okay. So I called Dr. Osborne. I emailed him copies of Dr. Wayne Ross's report. And I called him and he said, well, since Dr. Ross and Dr. Osborne are medical professionals, I'll allow Dr. Ross to speak with Dr. Osborne. I said, okay. I said, okay. So that conference call, okay, took place in the office of the Dauphin County coroner. Mm-hmm. Here in Harrisburg, okay? There were the people present were Dr. Wayne Ross, the Dauphin County coroner, and myself. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Ross interviewed Dr. Osborne on the phone. When he got finished asking him questions, and Dr. Osborne, he wasn't happy with the way Dr. Osborne was answering his questions. He stopped talking to Dr. Osborne, and I started talking to him and asking him questions. I said, Dr. Osborne, I said, right when we were finishing up our conversation, I said, Dr. Osborne, can you tell me why you changed the cause and manner of death from homicide to suicide?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And these, you know, what his response is in, you know, I mean, it's burnt on my brain.
Yeah, this is the question everyone wants to know the answer to.
Yeah, he responded with, okay, I did it at the insistence of the police.
Okay.
And I said, can you tell me who they are? I said, did they have a degree in pathology? I said, do any of the officers that you talked to have a degree in pathology? And with that, the call ended, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And now Dr. Osborne is in Florida. I don't know if anyone has had the chance to read the depositions of Dr. Galeno and Dr. Osborne.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but Dr. Osborne and Dr. Galeno, when counsel for the Greenberg, Joe Pedraza, mm-hmm. Joseph Pedraza, when he deposed both of those individuals, if you read their deposition, the transcript of their depositions,
yeah,
Mr. Pedraza interviews Dr. Osborne and Dr. Galeno regarding Dr. Galeno's performance. Okay?
Uh-huh.
They say in their depositions, you know, there were never any problems. No problems at all. Okay, none of whatsoever.
Yeah.
Tony, I have three memos signed by the deputy, okay, medical examiner,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Gary Collins, who is now the medical examiner for the state of Delaware. Three memos,
mm-hmm.
criticizing Dr. Osborne for his performance. Three different memos. Now, you have two medical professionals that lied under oath.
Sure.
They committed perjury.
Yeah. It's mind-boggling. How often is a cause of death changed at the insistence of the police?
So, it's never been for me.
Sure. Okay. Sure.
I'm speaking, you know, in excess of 800 homicides.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only case that I've ever heard.
Yeah. And obviously one that, I mean, it just defies logic when you look at it. It's not even that questionable as to this was not a suicide. It was a homicide, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. So to have that changed like that at the insistence of the police, I'm wondering what it would take and what is that pressure that they felt that they were under, that they should do that at the insistence of the police. Would there be some sort of backlash if they said, no, you're not a doctor. You're not a medical professional. This is what we believe is right. I don't know why one would even do that, even if someone did suggest that.
I don't know. And then, I know that, the medical examiner's office, when the pathologist does an autopsy, the reports are on a computer, okay, so that they could go in and out and make changes.
Sure. Okay.
Well, Dr. Osborne called it a homicide, okay? Dr. Osborne issued a death certificate for Ellen saying it was a homicide.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why would you come back and change it? Why? Why would you issue another death certificate saying suicide?
No, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, I know that the parents are obviously very upset about all this because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't bring justice. What was the reaction of Samuel Goldberg as these sort of things are happening? One would think, I mean, I'm engaged right now. If something like this happened to my fiance and I know I didn't do it, and there was this battle out there for suicide versus homicide, and it was just as suspicious of this, I'd be right next to the parents going, no, what, why is this not changing? What was his reaction as this was happening?
From what the parents have told me, what Josh told me, Sam's response was just barely, it was like he wasn't even there.
Okay.
Like he wasn't even there. Okay. From what I understand, he's remarried now, has two or three children, lives in a $2 million apartment in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
So,
a very, very bizarre response. Let's talk now. Obviously, all of that with the medical examiner and the suicide versus homicide, that's been a big question. And you really straightened a lot of that out and really spelled it out for us as far as how that all went down. We don't really know why those things happened, but we know the order in which they occurred. So as you've continued to try and reach out to the authorities for help in this, just pointing out the obvious, look, this happened a while ago. Some of these people aren't here anymore. And they continue to not do very much. Where does the investigation stand right now? Because if I remember correctly, I thought that they had reopened the investigation not that long ago, but then I haven't heard anything new since.
Sandy and Josh's first attorney,
okay,
was the Philadelphia DA, the individual who is the Philadelphia district attorney right now, okay, Larry Krasner. Okay. When I first got involved, okay, in 2013, one of the things that I noticed that Larry Krasner said that when he picked up the Ellen's laptops from the police, he gave them to an individual by the name of Cummings.
Okay.
That individual in turn sent her laptop to a company in North Carolina to do a forensic analysis on it.
Yeah.
Okay. That forensic analysis, okay, first of all, when the Philadelphia police had it, they gave it to the FBI.
Okay.
To do the forensic analysis. The FBI come back to the police saying there was nothing related to suicide on it. Well, when it came back, the report came back from North Carolina, they addressed the shadow searches, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Like if you went out and you looked up Zoloft, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Zoloft says, okay, if there's a possibility of suicide with Zoloft and all this other stuff, you know, and all these other related things.
Possibility of suicide, but not possibility of stabbing yourself 20 times.
Yes. Well, 20 times.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah.
Who are they trying to crap? Okay. But anyway, the first thing I did, I said to Josh, I said, Sandy's or Alan's father, I said, will you please call Mr. Krasner and tell him I'd like a copy of that report from North Carolina? They said, okay. So he called them and he said to me, he said, well, Larry Krasner said it's about, he said it's like a phone book. He says it's about as thick as a phone book. I said, I don't care what it is. I said, I'd like a copy.
Yeah.
So he sent me that copy. Well, guess what? Guess who said that, Larry Krasner had a copy and I had a copy. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was it. And Larry Krasner's copy was in the Greensburg's personal file.
Okay.
Well, when Larry Krasner recused himself when he became PA, he recused himself from this case and sent the case on to the state attorney general's office, Mr. Josh Shapiro, who is now our governor. Mm-hmm. Okay? And Josh Shapiro sat on it for 4.5 years.
Okay.
Before we found a conflict of interest. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Josh Shapiro, the attorney general, sends it back to Philly because he's now running for governor. He doesn't want anybody. He said, I don't want it even to appear like I have a conflict of interest. All this time I'm talking with the supposed lead investigator in the case was their deputy, senior deputy attorney general, Christopher Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Christopher Phillips is talking about, well, we did another analysis with the FBI and we come up with all these shadow searches.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, now he gives these shadow documents, copies of these shadow documents to Stephanie Farr, in Philadelphia, the journalist who did the big article on the Greenberg case.
Sure.
And okay, so Stephanie calls me and she says, Tom, I'm going to send you the documentation that he said. And I looked at it. And I said, I told him, I still have the emails that I sent back to him. I said, Mr. Phillips, I said, don't tell me you had the FBI do another analysis, because everything that I see now that you're saying is an indication of suicide, I said, I know where you got it. There were two individuals that have copies of that report, Larry Krasner and me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I had, when he did that, I had Sandy and Josh Greenberg send Krasner correspondence asking for their personal file. And he said, I sent it to you. Well, the Greenbergs don't have it.
Yeah.
So you take a look at, you're supposed to have a copy of this report. I'm supposed to have a copy of this report now. Chris Phillips from the AG's office has it.
Uh-huh.
I think when Larry Krasner sent the case to the AG's office, he also sent the Greenbergs' personal file along with it. Okay. God bless them. Josh and Sandy have been through so much on this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It stinks to high heaven. It just stinks to high heaven.
Well, there's so many directions that you'd think, well, if this person's not going to cooperate, maybe that person will cooperate. But there's whatever is going on here. They have a very strong hold against any direction or any headway that anyone can try and make into finding answers about what was going on here. And I hesitate, you know, it's bizarre to me that Samuel Goldberg has not been considered a suspect. I know he's off living his life now elsewhere, but why hasn't any sort of investigation just been done with him for just a little bit, at least to clear his name, if anything? But it seems, did they ever have a chance to look at his devices or anything of that nature?
No.
So a lot of the evidence that could point to someone, if it was possibly him, is now gone. And that's probably, if that was the game, if that's what was going on, they certainly succeeded at that by having a lot of those things wiped away, if that's indeed what was happening.
Well, you know, there is no way in heck they're going to do anything. The crime scene has been completely destroyed because the lofts that Ellen and Sam were in, those lofts were involved in two different floods over time, and they've been, where the apartment that they had has, that whole thing has been completely gutted, So, as far as anything, anything coming from the scene, that's not going to happen.
Sure.
Unless and until we see what the police have to offer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And here's the other thing, Tony. I don't know if you know. Okay. Guy D'Andrea.
Okay.
Okay. Guy D'Andrea was an assistant district attorney for the city of Philadelphia when this occurred. Okay. So he asks I befriended him. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He asks his supervisor if he could see the Greenberg file and take a look at it.
Yeah.
His supervisor, okay, who is Jennifer Selber, okay, tells him, yes, you can. Well, he finds the case in the closet, covered up with some Christmas decorations, with not even a file number assigned to it.
Oh, my God.
So he spends the next 2 days going through the file. One of the things that's missing, okay, if you'll take a look at the autopsy, okay, you'll see the paragraph in there that says, the specimen of the spinal cord was reviewed by Dr. Lucy Rourke, okay?
Okay.
And Dr. Rourke says, well, it's not severe enough, and the victim could continue to harm herself, okay? So as he's going through that file, he doesn't see a copy of, Dr. Adams' report.
Mm-hmm.
He calls the police. The police say, we don't have it. He calls the ME's office. The ME's office says, it doesn't exist. Okay? Now, you have this paragraph in there that Dr. Osborne put in there.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, deposition-wise, he said he hand-walked it. Could you see an individual walking through about a foot and a half of snow with this specimen, okay, from the ME's office over to CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, okay, to have Dr. Adams take a look at it, okay? I called Dr. Adams. Dr. Adams says, Tom, I've never heard of the case. I don't know who the Greenbergs are. I don't know anything about this case. And if I had known anything about it, I would have submitted a report and submitted an invoice for my work.
Sure.
There, no report exists and no invoices. There are reports and invoices prior to that. Okay. Dr. Adams did all the neural work for the ME's office in Philadelphia until she retired. Okay. Mm-hmm. She was not an employee, but she was like a consultant.
Yeah.
there are reports and invoices, you know, from before the 26th and 27th and 28th. Okay. Before that and after that, after the 28th, there are none for the 26th, 27th, and 28th.
There's so many things here. Let me ask you this, because obviously the obvious villain in cases like this, we look at the significant other, and there's obviously some suspicious things surrounding Samuel Goldberg in terms of what was said and his seeming indifference to his fiance being murdered or suicide and not having a whole lot of interest in the investigation of that. But is this something where, I mean, it conveniently looks like it could be possibly him, but never truly investigated? Or is there something else or someone else that we're completely unaware of, is not really on the public's radar, that would cause the authorities and all of these people to be in on some sort of a cover-up? Although many probably, if they are, don't even aware what they're covering up or why they're covering it up. But is there something deeper that we're looking at here beyond Samuel Goldberg? Is there other suspects in this case? I know Sam's not truly a suspect, but just from the outside looking in.
Well, you know, as far as I'm concerned right now, what I would like to see done is have this change from suicide to either undetermined or homicide.
And why is that? What does that open the door to by having that happen?
Once that's done, then you can just pursue a criminal investigation, a legitimate criminal investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when that is done, and we pursue a criminal investigation, mm-hmm. There are things like, Tony, okay, two knives were used in this homicide,
mm-hmm.
a smooth bladed knife and a serrated knife.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A serrated knife is found in Ellen's chest.
Okay.
The smooth bladed knife is not found. Where is it?
Mm-hmm.
Could an individual brought it to the scene and took it away? We don't know.
Sure.
Okay. All righty. They said, well, one of the things are that she didn't display any defensive wounds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, that's bullcrap. If you take a look at the excised wrists, okay, both wrists mm-hmm. of Ellen, there's bruising and all on both wrists.
Yeah.
So don't tell me that, you know, that there are no defense wounds. There are.
Yeah.
There are defense wounds. And, you know, it's things like that that, you know, you take a look at and, you know, and as a homicide investigator, you sit back and you go, well, cripe, what the hell is wrong with you guys?
Yeah.
You guys,
I mean, if they
blind or what?
If they can't even accept basic facts of the case, things that really are not trying to be disputed, just here's what the facts are. Here's what the evidence shows. Yeah. And to not even recognize it.
You take a look at Ellen's scalp. Okay,
yeah.
Right here, there's a 6.5 centimeter wound
mm-hmm.
that goes right down to the scalp. Right down to the scalp. That's where a majority of the blood came, okay,
mm-hmm.
at the scene. What is that? Okay. Any investigator, I mean, worth his salt, would take a look at that and say, whew, that's either fight or flight.
Mm-hmm. Very much
she
so.
She was either fighting with the individual or trying to get away.
Can you clear up for us the door lock? Because that always is another interesting point on this, where it's similar to a hotel door lock. It's the latch that goes over. And the story that we had heard was that when he got up there after getting the maintenance person who couldn't break in, but then Samuel actually did break down the door, said, well, it was locked from the inside. Looks like, oh, well, then how could you have possibly been in there? And he did check out on security cameras as being at the gym in some of that time window. What can you speak to about the lock and that time window as well and the alibi that Sam has?
Well, if you take a look at that, the door lock, okay,
mm-hmm.
that sliding bar lock, okay, is mounted on the door and the door jamb.
Okay.
In order for that lock, okay, to open up, once it's placed as it should be in a lock position, mm-hmm. you one or the other piece has to be completely dismounted, you know, mm-hmm. before it would open.
Sure.
Before you could get in. The particle board door on the apartment has the mounting for that lock. There's four screws in. Okay. Mm-hmm. One of them are out. Three are still in mounted. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a particle board door. Where should the particle from that door be in that screw?
Okay.
That particle board, you know, there wasn't any, you know, you take a look at the floor. Yeah. It's not there.
Okay.
So, Dr. Lee, who was a very, I don't know if you ever heard of him. Mm-hmm. A renowned forensic scientist. He has his own institute up at the University, you know, Connecticut.
Sure.
I send it up there and I ask him to take a look at it, to take a look at this case. Mm-hmm. And he comes back and he says, Tom, you know, to me, it's a homicide. And he said, to me, there's evidence of cleaning up. Mm-hmm. And I also had a crime scene analyst, a detective. I had him take a look at it. He says the same thing. Okay. So when you see they don't find, you know, that there's three screws still in the door. Mm-hmm. Okay. The fourth screw, you can't find it anywhere. You take a look at the floor. There isn't any evidence. There should be some type of wood chips or something there.
Sure.
There's nothing. Nothing. Nothing.
Because he broke the door down, correct? This is what the story is. Do we know that he truly did break the door down the way it's described?
No.
Okay.
No. I have my own thoughts regarding what was done with that lock. So, you know, and I, you know, I'd rather just, you know, leave it as is. Mm-hmm. The Pennsylvania State Police, God bless them, they sent me to locks, you know, lock picking school down in Florida. Okay.
Yeah.
For a couple of weeks. And I did all the surreptitious entries, you know, for the state police. So don't tell me that, you know, anything about, you know, don't tell me that you hit that door with your shoulder. You mm-hmm. didn't do that.
Okay.
You didn't do that. And there are, you know, there are other witnesses, okay? We have other witnesses who said that, you know, different things that they heard Sam talking. Now, the one witness, if you take a look at his statement, he says, you know, he's down the hall from the apartment, but he sees Sam and he's looking, you know, through this little peephole in the door, and he sees Sam walking in the hallway. Mm-hmm. What he says Sam is saying, if you listen to that 911 call, Sam is indicating to the 911 operator that he's in the room. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, we have a witness that says, no, he wasn't in the room when he was saying that. He was walking in the hall.
Really?
So, you know, all these things, you know, all these things are questionable.
Mm-hmm. So
all these things are out there. Okay. And we need answers to them.
Yeah.
Okay. Guy D'Andrea, this assistant district attorney in the homicide prosecution unit in Philadelphia, when I befriended him, he took a look at this case, okay? And he said, Tom, my yellow sticky should be all over that case. I said, yeah. He said, as a matter of fact, he said, every time I thought, you know, well, I'm not really sure about this, he said, I would propose my things to other people in the office. And he said the only thing everybody said was, hey, it's a homicide. It's a homicide. It's a homicide. So now you have Guy D'Andrea, okay, the assistant DA in the office, okay, at the time, takes a look at it. He said it's a homicide. Mm-hmm. He tells a supervisor, Jennifer Selber, you know, Jennifer, I think this is a homicide.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Okay. The same folks, okay, same folks. Jennifer Selber, Christine Heim, Christopher Phillips. Guess where all those people went when they left Philadelphia?
Where?
The AG's office. Pennsylvania Attorney General's office.
Mm-hmm.
So now Krasner comes in, gets the case. He comes in as DA, gets the case, refers it, recuses himself, and refers it to the Attorney General's office.
Mm-hmm.
The same people who were in the Philadelphia District Attorney's office.
Yeah.
These people aren't going to say, oh, now it's a homicide. We're
no, it just keeps juggling back and forth to the same people who don't want to do anything on this.
They didn't do nothing. They didn't do a damn thing. Not a damn thing.
Have you looked in? I'm sure you have. Is there, I guess the question is more so, is Samuel Goldberg well enough connected that there could theoretically be a cover-up going on here for people that don't want, you know, him to ruin his life or what have you for a murder, if in fact that took place, that would have the capability of covering this up to the level that on the surface it appears to be being covered up by?
Well, you know, I refer to this case, okay, as not enough litter in the box.
Okay.
And I keep telling everybody, you can stretch around in a box as much as you want.
Mm-hmm.
There's not enough litter in there, and you know, it's still going to stink.
Mm-hmm.
It will always stink. And, you know, I'm sorry, but up and until this occurs, you know, and you know, I don't know if you know Gavin Fish. He's also a podcaster like you.
Okay.
Gavin Fish received a letter from an individual who said that he was an attorney representing, okay, he represented Schwartzman and the Goldbergs.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And it was a cease and desist letter to Gavin. And he said, you know, he said that he says in his letter that Sam called Kanian Schwartzman, who is Jimmy Schwartzman's son.
Okay.
Kanian put Jimmy on the phone, and they were both talking to Sam prior to Sam's 911 call, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What did they advise Sam to do?
Yeah, what?
What were they advising Sam?
That is the question. Yeah, what is going on?
What are they advising Sam?
And why would he be calling?
Won't answer. They won't, you know, they won't take my calls. They won't sit down with me.
So what's their cease and desist about? Just talking about the case in general?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the fact that, you know, Gavin says, okay, the Attorney General's office, you know, Josh Shapiro went to school with Jimmy Schwartzman's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both on the same fundraising committees for the academy, private academy that they were in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And their children on the same athletic teams.
Mm-hmm.
So That's when Josh Shapiro said, we may have a conflict here. Although we don't have a conflict, we may, you know, rather than make it appear like a conflict, we would rather accuse ourselves and send the case back to Philadelphia.
Wow.
Okay. Now, according to law, then it has to go to a, you know, a neighboring, you know, county.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent it to Chester County. They sent the case to Chester County. So now it's with the Chester County District Attorney's Office.
Mm-hmm. And that's where it sits right now.
That's where it sits. It's been sitting there probably at least 7 months.
Is there a reason why they haven't done anything yet? Or is it just a convenient...
I don't know what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
I called the chief county detective, David Sessa, and David tells me, yep, Tom, we just got everything together and we're taking a look at it. You know, blah, blah, blah. So,
and it sits.
We'll be talking to you. Okay, David.
Yeah.
I'm here. They still haven't talked to me.
How bizarre. And what's amusing to me is also the attempt to try and quiet people from just discussing this. That seems very...
You know, in Philadelphia, okay, the judge in Philadelphia, okay, we filed the case because Joe Pedraza, our attorney, God bless him,
mm-hmm.
he and Will Trest, they are, you know, they're very aggressive attorneys. And in this case, they outdid themselves simply because, I mean, they just really outdid themselves. But anyway, Joseph Pedraza and Will Trask, they filed saying that, you know, the medical examiner's office was capricious in their decision to say suicide.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
Arbitrary and capricious, okay? So the judge in Philadelphia says, okay, this thing is going to trial with, you know, Philadelphia says no. The city of Philadelphia argues otherwise. They say, no, we aren't. The judge says, yes, you are. We're going to trial this date. Okay, they appeal it. Judge says, nope, your appeal is bad. City, we're going to trial. City appeals it. Now we're in Commonwealth Court. Commonwealth Court, Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court, heard this case back in November. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We still don't have a decision from Commonwealth Court on what it is. Three judges from Commonwealth Court, Pennsylvania, heard it. The judge in Philadelphia did a 16-page opinion and sent it to Commonwealth Court on why he says, you know, he denied the city's appeals.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. That case is still pending, and we also have a civil case, and we've named Dr. Osborne, Dr. Galeno, and Dr. Lindsay Emery, a neuroforensic pathologist,
mm-hmm.
who, during her deposition, said that the one wound specimen that she examined was post-mortem. Now, how the hell do you stab yourself in the back of the neck after you're dead?
Is that going to be, you think, the direction that going after this civilly initially that may open up criminal charges at some point by being able to get information through discovery on a civil case, and then enough comes out and it goes, well, look at this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, because, you know, they have to, you know, if once we go, you know, on these civil cases, I think possibly in August we are going to go out and say, okay, here's the subpoenas. We want a copy of everything, copy of all the records, you know.
Yeah.
All of it. Everything that you have, we want. So, you know, and then we'll take a look at what they have, okay? But, you know, Tony, I have never, ever, okay, and I'm looking at this, and, the father says to me, he said, well, I don't think you've ever taken a look at a case like this. And as you know, in the past years, I would say to him, well, I don't think so. But, you know, honestly, today I can honestly say I have never, ever had a case like this, ever.
So bizarre. And just,
I mean,
so
it really, yeah. I mean, it really, really, really reeks.
It does. And it's in coming from such obvious places. And that's the scary part. It's
the politics, yeah. The money, you know, it's just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Well, it's certainly, I mean, it's heartbreaking for those parents who wanted to try and find some sort of resolution and, I mean, closure, if you can even have closure when you lose your daughter, but just something. And the denial of that to them is just heartbreaking. We're going to go ahead.
I look at things and we just had a state police luncheon for the retirees. Okay? Mm-hmm. There were over 100 there. Okay.
Yeah.
They're all looking at me and going, because of all this thing, all this, you know, all of it that was in paper, yeah, and all this other stuff. And I said, you know, what the hell is going on, Tom, with that Greenberg case you're doing? I said, guys, I'm sorry, guys. I just don't know. I really don't know. And you're talking to an individual, okay, that had, you know, number one, he advised the last appointed attorney general of his rights. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the next day when I was doing the same thing to the governor, who lost his memory, and politicians after politicians after politicians, you know, and then you take a look at, you know, you take a look at this case. And I told Sandy and Josh right at the beginning, I said, you folks are going to have to be extremely, extremely patient. And if you don't want to fight, then I think we should, you know, I should walk away.
Yeah.
And they said, no, they're in it for the long run. And God bless them both. And I told them, they asked me, they said, why? And I said, because you don't understand about Philly politics. And they said, what? I said, Philly politics, I don't care what anybody says. You know, I worked Philly politics. I had the organized crime with the state police. I worked in Philly, mm-hmm, 3 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Philly politics are so corrupt. And I don't care what anybody says. Mm-hmm. They are so corrupt. I mean, Philly is just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. You know, I worked with Philly Major Crimes, Philadelphia PD Major Crimes, for 8 years. Mm-hmm. 8 years we worked with Pennsylvania State Police and Philadelphia Major Crimes all together. You know, I went after people like Rizzo's son, you know, Mayor Rizzo's son-in-law.
Sure.
And arrested him.
Yeah.
You know, you know, you take a look at this and you wonder what's going on here?
Why? Yeah.
Tell me why the city of Philadelphia is expending all of these resources on this.
Yeah.
Why can't they just come out and say, undetermined, see you later?
Yeah.
You guys go do what you want to do.
Yeah.
Go investigate your ass off. Uh-uh.
Yeah. What are they hiding? Why are they hiding it? I mean, does it have anything to do with Sam? Who knows? I mean, exactly. Just to find out, just to be able to go down that road, and you hit the roadblock every time.
Yeah. Why?
You're locked into the Hidden Killers podcast.
Want more? Start binging on all of our true crime podcasts right now through Apple Podcasts and get an ad-free experience when you sign up to be a True Crime Today Premium Plus member, exclusively on Apple Podcasts.
More of the Hidden Killers podcast, dropping soon.
Press subscribe now.